from under the heavens, thou shalt not forget. Right? So the concept is, never forget to totally obliterate their memory.
But so be it as may, it's not to remember it.
I was, that came
well, there are two mitzvahs. There's
that
a mitzvah.
Came to mind today, yeah. I was like, right. Who remembers the Amalekites? Except right. The Jews did.
That's right, that's right. But there are two mitzvahs. There's a mitzvah to eradicate Amalek. And according to the Rambam, that mitzvah is quite literal. According to the Rambam, if I meet an Amalekite today that I can identify as an Amalekite, I as an individual am halachically obligated to pull out my gun and shoot them. This is what the Rambam says. Now, others say, they view it a little differently. They view the destruction of Amalek as a royal or governmental type of mitzvah, meaning to say that society as a whole must endeavor to eradicate the Amalekite nation, but consequently, when there is no nation, or even if I would kill one, I wouldn't really be getting rid of the whole nation, there is no mitzvah qua individual to go out and destroy Amalek. And that is why there are some opinions that are brought down in Halacha that say that the final mitzvah of destroying Amalek will not be fulfilled until the coming of Mashiach. Now, that is only one mitzvah. That is the mitzvah that is called Mechias Amalek, to eradicate or destroy Amalek. There is another mitzvah that very much does apply today, and that is a mitzvah called Zechiras Amalek, to remember the evil that Amalek has perpetrated against us. That's Zachor, Eis Asher Asa Lecha Amalek. Remember what Amalek did to you, Baderech, when you were on the road, B'tseischa Mimitzrayim, when you left Egypt. Now that is a mitzvah of remembrance, not eradication. I'll give you an example. We paskin, for example, that this mitzvah of reading Parshas Zachor, although generally speaking, Kriyas HaTorah is considered to be a rabbinic edict. The Torah does not say anywhere, you have to read the Torah. The only place where the Torah says specifically there has to be a public reading of the Torah is the 613th mitzvah, the very last mitzvah, I'm sorry, 612th mitzvah, the next to the last mitzvah in the Torah, and that's every 7 years during Sukkot. There was a public reading of the Book of Devarim by the king. And we are told that's the mitzvah called Hakel, get everybody together to Yerushalayim. And the Torah emphasizes Ha'anashim, the men, Vahanashim, and the women, Vahataf, and even the little babies. Everybody shows up. We don't even have babysitting. The babies are supposed to be present at this mass Torah reading. That is the only explicit reference in the five books of Moses to the public reading of the Torah. However, Chazal have told us that because there is a mitzvah called remembering Amalek, the annual remembrance of Amalek, which we do by the reading of Parshas Zachor, the Shabbos before Purim, is in fact the fulfillment of a Torah command. So for example, in 2 weeks, not in 2 weeks, but 3 weeks, right before Purim, we're going to read the regular Parsha of the week, which will be, I guess, probably Tetzaveh, right? Will be the regular Parsha of the week. And then the Maftir, the special last Aliyah, will be Parsha Zachor. So keep in mind that the first 7 Aliyos are only the fulfillment of a rabbinic edict. There's no Torah commandment to read the Torah. Although the Torah is the Torah, of course, but there's no commandment to read the Torah. But the reading of that maftir is the fulfillment of a Torah commandment. And that is the commandment to remember Amalek by the, and Chazal have a tradition, that this mitzvah is fulfilled by a public reading of the Torah. That's why you will find, I don't know what they do here, but in many shuls, they will read the Parsha Zachor a second time in the afternoon, primarily for the benefit of maybe women with children who did not make the first service. They don't do it for any other Torah reading. If you don't make it, you don't make it. But Parshas Zachor, which is considered to be a mitzvah min haTorah, they will actually have a separate reading. Now, if truth be told, there is really a technical machlokus whether women have the mitzvah of remembering Amalek. Because after all, the mitzvah of destroying Amalek is a mitzvah concerning warfare, and women are normally exempt from warfare. So the Sefer Achinuch says, since they're exempt from destroying Amalek, they're also exempt from remembering Amalek, But we paskin that the two mitzvahs are not correlated. So even if you're not somebody who's commanded in the warfare aspect, there's still a mitzvah of Zohar. The Magen Avraham writes, by the way, that if a woman did not hear the laming of Parshas Zohar, she should be sure to come to Shul early enough on Purim, and when they read the story of Amalek in Parshas Beshalach, you could be Yotzei Parshas Zohar with the reading of those verses in Beshalach. Many Achronim argue, because although Parshas Beshalach gives us the narrative of Amalek, Parshas Beshalach does not use the words "remember Amalek." That only appears in Devarim, and consequently, some have argued you can only fulfill the mitzvah of Parshas Zohar by reading verses that call upon you to remember. Let's put it this way: we read it as a special reading only once a year, but keep in mind that it's also part of the regular Torah reading cycle.
What about on Purim day? Do we read it as well?
No, Purim we read Beshalach by Yavol Amalek. Purim, we read the actual story of their attacking us. So the Magen Avraham suggests that you could be Yotzei Parshas Zohar by hearing that reading. But others say no, because that reading does not contain the words "remember, remember Amalek."
There's the concept of a Shnei Mikra V'Epitardim.
Yes.
Where is that based on?
You're asking a general question now.
Yeah. Well, yes. As you said, reading the Torah, there's only a couple specific...
Oh, I see what you're saying. The halacha that he's referring to is a halacha that unfortunately is ignored in the breach, by and large. Many people don't do it, but it is a halacha that one should read the Parsha every week. You can either do it a little bit a day, or all on Shabbos, or all on Friday. And when you read the Parsha of the week, you should read each verse twice, and you read the Aramaic translation of the verse, Unkelus, once. Some say that Rashi's commentary would be a substitute for the Unkelus, except when there's no Rashi on a pasuk, you have to read the Targum Unkelus. Others say you should do Unkelus and Rashi. Now, be it as it may, this is called Shnayim Mikra, reading the verse twice, the Echad Targum, and one translation. Again, on one level, reading Unkelus doesn't make a lot of sense to us. See, the original idea was Aramaic was the spoken language, so the concept would be you'd read the verse twice and then see the translation. One would almost assume that perhaps you should take an art scroll chumash, as it were, read the pasuk twice and then read the English. Nevertheless, in halacha, there's still a special role for Targum Unkelus. Although it's Aramaic and it's not our spoken language, it is said that the Targum was composed with Ruach HaKodesh. The art scroll, as fine a translation as it is, was not composed with Ruach HaKodesh. Although it's interesting that, you think about that, I saw this once, this was very, very funny because it was so jarring. At one of the art scroll banquets, they were giving out chumashim to donors. You know, if you gave $1,000, you got a free chumash. So it was inscribed by Rabbi Sherman, who's the translator. So it says, this chumash is being given to so-and-so, compliments of the author. Of course, the author of the chumash is not Rabbi Sherman, but okay, be it as it may. So maybe it is written with Ruach HaKodesh, who knows? I'm sorry, did you want to say something? Yeah, it's a very good question. It's a very good question, and my guess would be that if the sages would be making that enactment now, they might say English. But nevertheless, the classical halachic sources do talk about the special sanctity of the Targum Unkelus. Now, I just want to say, where did it come from? It's not a Torah law. It is not a Torah law. It's a rabbinic enactment to try to ensure that people have familiarity with the Torah.
But
Oh yes. Shnayim Mikra V'Yechad Targum. And it says, Kol Hamashlim Parshiosa V'Matzivor. When you finish the Torah Parshios, together with the congregation, you finish the yearly cycle, it's considered to be a blessing for a long life. So it's an important thing. Many people don't do it. That's too bad. Number one, among other things, you can get a good familiarity. I mean, first of all, everyone should learn the Parsha week, even if whatever reason you don't do it in that particular form of Shnayim Mikra V'Yechad Targum, which is a halacha. But to finish the Parsha of the week, I mean, I know, for example, when I was in yeshiva, there were like Hasidic kids there too. Now, by Hasidim, they're very strict upon this. This is one of the things that Hasidim are very conscientious from a young age to do Shnayim Mikra V'Yechad Targum. And you know, you could be with a ninth grade kid, like, who knows all of the Chumash and all of the Rashi. you know, just because of going over it so many times every year from the time they were five, you know. So they went, so by the time they're 14, they've done it nine times. So it's a, you know, it's something. It's a good. It's obviously, it's a very good thing. Good thing to have. So, to the extent you know, you could do it, it would be a worthwhile thing. But be it as it may, as I say, that's not a Torah requirement, and therefore it does not. It's not included in a d'oraisa kriyasa Torah. So anyway, the point that we were developing yesterday was the teaching of the Gemara in Maseches Bava Basra that the downfall of Amalek takes place only through the children of Rachel and not through the children of Leah, and consequently we needed a Malchus of Shaul to kind of pave the way for King David, and consequently we also need a Mordechai and an Esther who are descendants of Shaul according to the rabbinic understanding of Kish and Mordechai's lineage, and therefore they are Mesakein, they rectify the chisaron of, in other words, what their ancestor failed to do in terms of killing Agag was rectified by Mordechai and Esther in killing Haman. But of course, again, there are difficult issues because obviously Amalek was not eradicated. Haman's children were killed, but his grandchildren were not. And according to the standard text in the Gemara, some of the grandchildren or the descendants did become Jewish. There are other questions as well, again, in terms of halakhic issues. For example, it says at the end of the Megillah, just to get ahead a little bit, that after Haman was hung, and of course one of the strange things about the Megillah Esther is that people don't realize that when they think the story ended, it really didn't end. And as we think, I mean, obviously, we think that, you know, when Haman gets hung, you know, Baruch Hashem, end of story, everything's good. But if you read the rest of the Megillah, you see, Haman's death just meant Haman's death. Haman was dead. But because of the peculiarities of Persian law, whereby a decree of the king could never be annulled, even by the king, right? So there is still this decree on the Jews that come the 13th of Adar, they're going to get wiped out. And the most that Achashverosh could do is Achashverosh could not cancel that decree, but he simply gave the Jews the right to either engage in self-defense or perhaps actually be the aggressors against their enemies. But there was a war, right? So we have to understand that the downfall of Haman was not the end of the story. But it does say at the beginning of chapter 8, if you look at Perek Ches Pasuk Aleph, Vayom Ahu, that day, meaning the day that Haman was hung, Nasan Hamelech Achashverosh li Esther Hamalka, the king Achashverosh gave to Esther the queen, Es Beis Haman Sorer HaYehudim, the house, of course, it'll be an important question how you translate house, but the house of Haman, the adversary or the enemy of the Jews. Then the next pasuk goes on and says the king took off the ring that he had given to Haman as a sign of royal authority, and he had given it to Mordechai. Now, there is a halachic question here too, because if you remember, the mitzvah to eradicate Amalek does not only apply to Amalek's the person of Amalek, but remember it, when Hashem commanded Shaul to eradicate Amalek, the command was destroy the property, destroy the sheep, destroy the cattle, destroy the possessions. Utterly eradicate. In other words, there seems to be a mitzvah to even destroy the very possessions of Amalek, not just the physical, again, not just the people. So the question would be, what would the halachic heter be for Esther to receive Beis Haman, the house of Haman? Right? Chara, these are the possessions of Amalek. If they're the possessions of Amalek, don't they have to be destroyed? Rashi says in Chumash, when Rashi says on the verse, destroy Amalek, I'll just read you the exact words of Rashi. Yeah, this would be in Kisetze. It says, Timcha as Zecher Amalek, erase the memory of Amalek. Rashi says, Mi'ish v'yad isha, from man until woman, me'olel v'adyonek, from child until even nursing baby, mishor v'adseh, from the ox unto the sheep, shelo yehe shem amalek nisgar, that the name of Amalek should not be remembered, afilu al behema, even on an animal. Laimar behema zu shel Amalekite. We don't even want somebody to point to a horse and say, or a cow and say, that belonged to Amalek. So the Chari, the Mefarshim, do ask the Kasha, how could there be a heter for Esther to receive as base Haman? L'chaira, there's a mitzvah to destroy Amalek's property. Yeah, there are a lot of different answers that are given. One particular answer is this. They draw an analogy to another halacha. The halacha is that Jewish people were commanded when they entered the land of Israel not to wage war against Moabite territory, because the Moabite territory on the east bank of the Jordan was given to Lot, and therefore until Mashiach comes we can't touch it. And yet we find that a lot of the territory that the 2.5 tribes dwelt in was once Moabite territory that had been conquered by Sichon, the king of Amori. And when the Jews waged war with Sichon, they settled in that land. That land belonged to Moab. So the Gemara's answer is, Moabite territory became permitted once it was taken over by Sichon. Meaning to say, the Jewish people didn't wage war against the Moabites. The Moabites lost it because of their war against the Amorite king, Sichon. Once the Amorite king took it, then we have a right to take it from him. Right? The phrase the Gemara uses is, Moab tiaru b'Sichon. Moabite lands became purified via the conquest of Sichon. So some want to suggest the following. Haman was hung officially, if we had to figure out, there's no indication there was a trial here, but if we had to figure out what was the legal ground for Haman to be hung, technically it was treason. Why was it treason? Because he was plotting the genocide of the queen's nation, of the nation of a member of the royal family, albeit perhaps unintentionally. Moreover, this last event, right, when he was seen on his knees in front of Esther, and there was some thought perhaps he was doing something improper. Well, in the ancient world, having an affair with the queen would be considered to be treason. I mean, legally today it wouldn't be treason because we would separate the person from the government. But where the king is the state, any insulting behavior vis-a-vis the king is considered to be treason vis-a-vis the entire state. Now, there is a principle that halacha recognizes that says those who are killed by virtue of treasonous activity, these are called morei b'malchus, nichsehem lamelech, their property reverts to the king. Meaning, if somebody is killed because of a crime, a person's killed because he murdered or was mechalel Shabbos, his property goes to his heirs. There's no forfeiture of property. Right? So just because somebody's killed, even if he's an oved avodah zarah, his kids get his property. But the halacha says, if somebody is killed because they're moreid b'malchus, they rebel against the king, their property goes to the king. So consequently, if Haman was killed because of his rebelliousness against the king, the property would technically revert to Achashverosh. Consequently, when Esther is getting the property, Esther is not taking possession of the property of Amalek. Esther is taking possession of property that already belonged to Achashverosh. In fact, that's why the pasuk even uses the phrase Nasan Hamelech Achashverosh. Achashverosh gave it, and therefore, you see the analogy. Just as the Talmud says, the Jewish people were allowed to conquer Moabite territory once it had become, as it were, laundered through Sichon, the king of the Amori. So too, says some Achronim, Mordechai and Esther are permitted to take possession of the property of Amalek as long as it passed through someone else's hands first, and according to the halacha, it would have become Achashverosh's property based on the halacha of Haruge Malchus, those that are killed because they rebel against the king, Nichseihem, their property belongs to the Melech. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. Do you mean laundering the way that I just used it?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you're referring to drug laundering or other types of things. Well, well, all right, I don't want to comment on that. I mean, it's true that there have been abuses, and sometimes we have examples of good ideas being taken too far. Maybe some of the excesses are an example of that. But this is an answer that's given by the Oneg Yom Tov. But again, there are a lot of questions here. I mean, if it's Amalek, why weren't Haman's grandchildren killed? Maybe we're simply dealing with the lack of power. The Jews didn't have the right to do that. You know, the halacha may say a certain thing, but they're not in control, in total control of the situation. Okay, so those are at least the three, the three primary elements that we see in the Megillah, and we'll identify more as we go along. One is the concept that even the ordinary, the everyday, the so-called coincidental, ultimately is a divine pattern. That's called the Nes Nistar, the hidden miracle. In fact, that's the whole reason why, you know, why do people dress up on Purim? You know, if you walk into the, I don't mean dress up, but wear masquerades or costumes, you may notice now in the stores, all of the stuff that is sold in the States around Halloween is now being sold for Purim. You know, masks, no masks, and ghosts, and all sorts of things, because that's the one time of year. Just like you can get your Christmas lights around Sukkot time. It's interesting. You see the lights that they sell around Sukkot time are what is made for Christmas trees. And just like the masks that are made for Halloween, but here they're made for Purim. Right? So why is there a custom to dress up, to wear costumes or masks on Purim? There's a very, very profound reason. And one should be very careful. You know, people sometimes dismiss Jewish customs of this nature as, well, this is what little kids do. We like to give kids fun, etc. And of course, that's true. But there's usually a very, very deep reason as well. And the deep reason is because a mask reminds us that appearances are deceiving. That what you see is not what you get. I can wear, you know, a lion mask, but that doesn't mean I'm a lion. Underneath, I'm something else. The whole story of Purim is to remind us that this entire world is a mask. That things that seem to be coincidence, normalcy, just the way things are, a series of events, no special miracles, no divine intervention. But that's just a mask, that there's an underlying reality that's much, much deeper, and that God is running the show. And that's a very, very fundamental lesson, because the lesson is, don't see God only in the miraculous, see God in the ordinary and the everyday. Recognize that there are masks that have to be stripped away. And if, let's say, in the mask of the Wizard of Oz, right? You know, remember the Wizard of Oz. There, you had the facade of the miraculous, where the underlying reality was just some guy behind a curtain who pushed a sound and light show. Do what?
Pay no attention to that man.
Right. Well, we're the opposite. This universe is a reverse Wizard of Oz type of scenario, where what seems to be going on is just normal, ordinary, like clockwork. The world just goes on based on the invariable and violent laws of nature. In fact, behind the scenes, there's a real Wizard of Oz, Lahavdil, that is truly running the show. And that's why it's very important and significant that the Book of Esther and the story of Purim is the only miracle, really, that is recorded to have taken place during the Gullus, during the 70 years. Because Gullus, when we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, and when we don't have lands, our land is the time of Hester Panim, when God's face is concealed from us. And Purim has to teach us that even when there's Hester Panim, there is divine love and divine intervention to protect us.
Why do we celebrate Purim at this particular time of year?
The reason why we celebrate Purim this particular time of the year is that the Book of Megillah records that Haman's decree was that the Jewish people should be eradicated on the 13th of Adar. We'll discuss why that was the date, but that is the date, 13th of Adar. And when that decree was finally superseded, or at least supplemented, by the right to bear arms, the Jewish people waged war against their enemies on the 13th of Adar, and we were able to achieve a repose or a rest on the 14th of Adar. So to commemorate the fact that we were able to rest from our enemies on the 14th of Adar, the rabbis of that generation, including Mordechai and Esther, enacted that the 14th of Adar should be celebrated as a day of celebration and thanksgiving. So the short answer is, Purim is on the 14th of Adar because that's the day of the victory.
It's quite interesting. In Gentile society, we have a calendar.
Yes.
Approximately the same time of the year.
Not exactly, but yeah.
Approximately the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Do you think it could be derived from that?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. It's hard to say because Purim seems to be directly connected to the historical event. Now, one interesting thing. Yeah. Are you talking about Mardi Gras? Which part?
Yeah, he's talking. Yeah, he's talking about carnival, which is Mardi Gras, which
right.
is
February.
That's because. They begin like a fasting.
Oh, so this is where you get to enjoy yourself before Lent.
before the fasting and whatever.
I'm saying it's
basically,
not. It seems it's a very different type of message. You know, we also have before Yom Kippur, right? We have the meal, but you know, it's hardly. You know, we really don't kind of go crazy before Yom Kippur. You get the last sins in before you do tshuva. You know?
We spent a whole month of tshuva before.
I'm saying, we work up to it.
Yeah. Okay. I spent a day of college and I was drinking and
I lived in New Orleans. I went to Loyola University for a number of years.
So you know it well.
I infiltrated in Catholic.
I do remember the one time I was extremely embarrassed. I know something about, when is Ash Wednesday?
It's the day after.
Okay. I had one of my law students, and I normally don't make any comment about somebody's appearance, but he had this dark spot on his forehead. And I guess whenever I said, you know, you have some dirt on your forehead, he's it's Ash Wednesday. Yeah, so excited. I better learn more about this.
After money.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, because the truth of the matter is, I never had, in 15 years of teaching largely Goyim, I never had a firm Catholic. I never had a Christian that had actual Ash on my forehead. Yes, I had mamish never seen it before. Okay. Okay.
You see a lot of, in more Catholic cities, you see a lot of, I know I was shocked.
Yeah.
You see all these.
Yeah, because
you know,
seemingly
normal-looking people.
Right,
you know.
Right. Well, you know, a chassan, this is a minute.
I said the same thing. Actually,
right.
I was embarrassed in the same way.
Yeah. You know, this is a minute that a lot of people don't do, but properly, when a person gets married, in addition to breaking the glass, which is a sign of mourning over Yerushalayim, there should be ashes placed on the forehead exactly where you put on tefillin. I mean, that is the halakha. The minute, the proper minute is to rub ashes on the forehead of a chassan, so he'll remember the Churban Beis HaMikdash.
So basically in his hair, though?
Well, at the hairline. It's filled with, you know, the bottom of the Rosh rests at the base of the hairline. So it doesn't have to be in his hair, but it's like, it doesn't have to be that visible, but it should be there. Okay, so that's why Purim. Now, one thing about the chronology that people don't realize how instrumental Pesach was in the Purim miracle. Because the truth of the matter is, that the actual hanging of Haman was 11 months before the Purim struggle. Meaning to say, Haman got this decree that the 13th of Adar, the Jews should be wiped out. Okay? But Haman issued that decree and it was sent out almost a year before it actually happened. And the whole story with Esther making a party and Haman getting hung, Haman got hung, according to rabbinic tradition, on either the second day of Pesach or the first day of Chol HaMoed, the third day of Pesach. Right? However, it was almost a year till the Jews, you know, were able to have that struggle against their enemies. Which is why some people have a minhag.
According to
the measure? Tegendi.
According to
the measure? Well, maybe that's it. I was going to mention another minhag. That one minhag is that people have a Pesachtik Hamintasha on the first day of Chol HaMoed. I don't know how you make a Pesach Dekamitash, with some type of...
Matzah meal.
With matzah meal, and you stuff it with some type of filling, because the first day of Chol HaMoed Pesach is the celebration of Haman's Dafel. So we don't realize. Esther's fast, for example. This is a common misconception.
Haman goes over.
That's right. We have a common misconception. If you ask most people, you know, the day before Purim, we have a fast. And that fast is called the Fast of Esther. Now, you ask most people, this is quite logical, why do we fast the day before Purim? Well, the answer is because in the Megillah it is recorded that when Esther went to beg mercy for her people, she requested all the Jews, Mordechai to request all the Jews to fast for 3 days and do tshuva. So of course, so to fast for 3 days is too hard for us, so we make it a one day fast. In other words, most people would say that the source of Tanis Esther is the source is based on Esther's fasting, not just Esther's, the Jewish people fasting at the request of Esther before Esther entered Achashverosh. Now the truth of the matter is, the Torah rejects that explanation for a very simple reason. He says, Esther's fast, really the Jewish people's fast, was not the day before Purim, was not the 13th of Adar. Esther's fast was Pesach time. In other words, according to Chazal, they actually fasted on the Yom Tov of Pesach. They didn't eat matzah that year.
Yeah.
The year before, 11 months before. It's not clear. It's not clear. It may have been in the days of the Gaonim. It's not clear that there's even a Talmudic fast called the Fast of Esther. I don't believe it's mentioned in Chazal. It's a minhag that dates, I think, from the time of the Gaonim. But I can try to check that. Now the Torah says the halachic makor for Tanis Esther is an unrecorded fast in the Megillah. And this is based on a passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi that says it was the ancient custom of Am Yisrael that before they engaged in military combats, they would fast the day of the war itself in order to seek divine assurance. Now that's a very strange thing, because you'd figure when you're going out to war, you know, you want to have a good breakfast that day. You want to be, you know, strong. And yet, yeah, the Jews relied on the spiritual thing, and certainly the more righteous Jews would fast. And therefore the Tanis Esther represents the fast of the 13th of Adar, which was the day of the combats against the Persian enemies. And therefore that is why we fast even to this very day. So it's interesting that the commonly understood association between the fast of Esther and the fast of the 13th of Adar, at least the Torah argues that that's not the reason. Now, other people differ. Other people say that in fact Tanis Esther is a memorial of that fast. We move it in Adar instead of Nisan simply because you're not supposed to fast during the month of Nisan. You know, so just a question of moving it. Of course, you may ask a question. If any of you are firstborn, you know that Erev Pesach, the firstborn children are supposed to fast in gratitude for the miracle of their being spared. And unless you go to a Siyam, you finish a Gemara, or you go to someone else who finished a Gemara. So that's the whole question. How are you allowed to fast on Nisan? Okay, but be it as it may, generally speaking, you don't make fast days during the month of Nisan. Okay, so, yeah. But the point is, there is a very strong connection between Pesach and Purim. And in fact, therefore, a large part of the redemption of the Jews from the Haman's Gezerah did occur during Pesach, when Haman was hung, and a new decree was promulgated, giving the Jews the right, 11 months later, to bear arms in defense against their enemies. Now, one other thing, just one preliminary point I want to talk about, and that is Hallel. You may raise a question, which the Gemara raises, and that is, on all Jewish holidays, we generally say Hallel, right? Special Psalms, Rosh Chodesh, we say Hallel, Sukkot, Pesach, Shavuos, Chanukah, although Chanukah is a rabbinic holiday, we say a full Hallel for 8 days. The only Yomim Tovim, or that we do not say Hallel for, is we don't say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, that you know. And that the Gemara gives us a reason. The Gemara says that since Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are days of judgment, Sifrei Chayim v'Sifrei Mason, the books of life and the books of death are opened up before God, so it's not appropriate to kind of express the exuberant joy of a Hallel. So we don't say Hallel because because we're a bit muted and somber on these days. All right, so that's for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But why don't we say a Hallel on Purim? So the Gemara gives three reasons why we don't say Hallel on Purim. Reason number one is we don't say Hallel on Purim because we fulfill the mitzvah of Hallel by reading the Megillah. Because Hallel is praise of God for His miraculous interventions. So the reading of the Megillah is our expression of Hallel. It is the surrogate fulfillment of Hallel. Because of this, the Me'iri has a very interesting halacha. The Me'iri writes that if a person is stranded on a desert island and does not have a Megillah, but he only has a sitter, the Me'iri says he is chayav, he is obligated on Purim, to recite Hallel with a bracha. Why? Because the Gemara says the only reason you don't say Hallel on Purim is because the Megillah is a substitute for Hallel. So the Me'iri argues if you don't have a Megillah, you got to read Hallel. That's the Me'iri's view. However, the Mishnah Brura does not paskin like that. We rule that not only is Megillah a way that you're Yotzei Hallel, but Megillah is the only way that you're Yotzei Hallel. Ironically, you're Yotzei Hallel only through Megillah. You're not Yotzei Hallel through Hallel. Hallel is not an appropriate Hallel on Purim. Only Megillah is an appropriate Hallel on Purim. And Rav Yitzchak Huttner once explained this in a very clear way. He says, the nature of Hallel, which is expressing gratitude to Hashem for miracles, needs to be of the same nature as the miracle itself. When the miracle is open, supernatural, and obvious, then you do your Hallel in an open, obvious way, praising God for His miraculous interventions. But when the miracle in question is hidden and subtle and concealed and non-obvious, then you are mechuyev to say your Hallel in a hidden, concealed, and non-obvious way. And that is the book of Esther, which does not mention Hashem's name. So consequently, Rav Huttner says, a neis nigla, an open and revealed miracle, requires a Hallel Galuya, an open and revealed Hallel. A Neis Nistar, a hidden miracle, requires a Hallel Nisteres, a concealed Hallel. This is how Rav Huttner explains why we don't follow the view of the Me'iri. But that's only one of the three answers the Gemara gives. Again, the question is, why don't we recite a Hallel on Purim? Answer number two the Gemara gives is a klal. By the way, this discussion, I'll come back to Yom HaTzimut in a second, because some of these answers are relevant to Yom HaTzimut, which, as you know, is Israeli Independence Day. There's considerable discussion whether Hallel should be recited with a bracha, without a bracha, and a lot of the discussion turns on these various answers in the Gemara. Now, answer number two of the Gemara is this. Ein Omrim Hallel, we do not say Hallel, al neis, on a miracle, Sheba Chutz La'aretz, that took place outside of the land of Israel. So Hanukkah was a miracle that took place in Israel. We have Hallel. But we don't say Hallel on Nisan that took place outside of the land of Israel. So the Gemara asks right away, what do you mean? What about the Hallel that we recite on Pesach? Because Hashem took us out of Egypt. That wasn't in Israel yet. So the Gemara's answer is, well, until the Jewish people came to Eretz Yisrael, on the way there, we could say Hallel for all miracles. But once we come to Eretz Yisrael, and there's Golus, we don't say Hallel on Nisim Shebuchutz Laretz. The Gemara makes the same point, by the way, Legabe prophecy. The Gemara says that the gift of prophecy is limited to the land of Israel. That one does not get prophecy. In fact, the Kuzari writes very beautifully. The Kuzari says, every climate and every environment is suitable for special products, right? So certain climates are good for oranges, certain climates are good for wheat, certain climates are good for sugarcane. Eretz Yisrael's climate is good for prophecy.
So this is Daniel.
Huh?
About Daniel.
Well, Daniel, if you recall, is technically not a prophet.
Daniel. Is there special? Isn't there? There's prophecy in the book of Daniel.
Well, this gets us into a complicated question. You know, we divide the Tanakh into three portions: Torah, Nevi'im, Kesuvim. Right, the Torah, the prophets, and the writings. Now, the book of Daniel is not classified in the Nevi'im. And just in terms of classification, the book of Daniel is classified in the writings. So here we have a question. I mean, you're asking a very good question. I mean, why isn't the book of Daniel one of the prophets? I mean, if prophecy is defined as telling the future, saying things that are going to happen, there's plenty of stuff in the book of Daniel about the Mashiach. In fact, Daniel even tells you how to figure out when Mashiach will get here. Trouble is, there's so many interpretations as to what that means, but he gives you a formula. He says 70 times 7, etc. It's one of those, you know, add this number to that number, and that number, and that number, and, you know, divide by 2, and you will come up with when Mashiach will come. And the Ramban made a calculation which didn't pan out, and the Malbim made a calculation that didn't pan out, and Rabbeinu Bechaya, there are different dates, and the truth of the matter is they probably are all right, we have to believe that these were Zmanim in which there could have been Mashiach, but the generation was not worthy. But the question still becomes, why is Yeshayahu a Navi and Daniel is only in the Ksuvim? And it seems to be that what we mean by prophecy is not merely the ability to tell the future and get a message from God, but rather, are you given the responsibility to communicate that message to the Jewish people? In other words, Daniel was not told to go out, he was told to record it, but he was not told to go out and teach it to anybody.
He was even told to keep it hidden.
Keep it hidden, that's right. So the essence of Nevuah is not merely your perception, but it's your being given the divine mission of proclaiming that message. And in that sense, the gift of Nevuah, says the Kuzari, is only in Eretz Yisrael, and yet the Kuzari says, until the Jews entered the land of Israel, prophecy could exist even in Chutz Laaretz. It's the same thing that the Gemara is saying by Moshe. Moshe is the best example. That's right. So the Gemara makes the same point. Until we come to Eretz Yisrael, we can say Halal even on Nisim Shebechutz Laaretz. Once we come to Eretz Yisrael and we're exiled, we don't make Halal for those miracles. Now the Gemara then gives a third answer. The third answer is that in order to say Hallel, one of the sentiments that Hallel expresses is Hallelu Avdei Hashem, servants of God, praise Hashem. You have to be a servant of God and not a servant of anybody else. Meaning, you're free, you're autonomous, you're not under the subjugation of the Ummah Ha'olam. But at the time of Hallel, at the time of Purim, the Jews could not call themselves exclusively the Avdei Hashem. Akati Avdei Achashverosh Anan. We are still the slaves of Achashverosh. And the Gemara seems to be making the point that what? You can only say Hallel when the miracle gives you a complete salvation. In the aftermath of Haman, the Jews were still in a precarious and vulnerable position. They were under Persian domination. Maybe the next guy could have been, you know, after Mordechai died, maybe the next guy could have been another Haman. In other words, they weren't out of the water yet. And if they're not out of the water just because there is this miracle, one cannot say Hallel. Now, so we have these three answers. One is, Megillah is the Hallel. The other is, we don't say Hallel al Neshe b'chutz l'aretz. But the third reason is we're still Avdei Achashverosh. Now, it is this third reason in particular that has furnished a lot of discussion about Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut. Because, once again, Yom HaTzmaut commemorates the day that the State of Israel was officially proclaimed in 1948, the 5th of Iyar, in Tafshir Ches. The very day of that proclamation was the beginning of a very bitter war, the War of Independence, in which there was a lot of casualties, and to some degree we're still in a situation where, at least with some of the Arab neighbors and internally, there is a state of war and a state of sakana. So some interpret it this way: if the Gemara is making the point You only say Hallel on Nisan, which you have been extricated from that particular threat. Some have suggested that Yom HaTzmaut still falls within what the Gemara calls Akati Avdei HaShersha. Now, it all depends. See, if you interpret the Gemara literally, that you don't say Hallel when you're still under foreign domination, then Yom HaTzmaut would be not that problem because it established a separate state. But if you interpret the Gemara to refer to the idea that you're not out of the water yet, then that might be a valid. In fact, some have argued that Yom Yerushalayim, which is the day that we regained Yerushalayim, there might be a stronger basis for the recitation of Hallel than Yom HaTzmaut, because Yom Yerushalayim, we did achieve, you know, a definable idea of capturing Yerushalayim. With Yom HaTzmaut, we're still in that state of war, in that state of danger, etc. But of course, keep in mind that given the fact that would be negotiations with the Palestinians, even Yerushalayim is up for grabs, unfortunately. Then, you know, maybe even after we think that issue, in other words, is it true that we've achieved something very definite? So this raises a lot of questions. Again, I'm not going to paskin. I mean, there are many, many different views, ranging from Hallel with a bracha to not saying anything at all, to Hallel without a bracha. So I think I've mentioned before the famous quip of the Panovich Rav and Panovich, the great yeshiva, where on Yom HaTzmaut, they do not say the Tachanun prayer, but they don't say Hallel. So somebody once asked the Panovich Rav, if you're such a great Zionist, why don't you say Hallel? So he says, well, he follows Ben-Gurion's practice on Yom HaTzmaut. He neither says Hallel nor says Tachanun. So he says he's a perfectly good. So this was well-known. Okay. But I would say, maybe we'll tell you Yom HaTzmaut when we're closer to that date. But halachically, just so you'll know, halachically, a lot of the discussion about Hallel, if we avoid the politics of it, is based on interpreting this passage of the Gemara, we're still the servants of Achashverosh, and you don't say Hallel when you're not out of the dangerous situation for which Hashem had redeemed you. So we do have to remember, the Jews are still under Persian domination. See, unlike Hanukkah, where the Jews achieved independence from the Yavan, here, we did not achieve independence. We are still under Persian domination. Okay. What time do you have?
354.
Okay. All right, so let's continue a little bit with the beginning of the Megillah. So the Megillah begins with this discussion of the man Achashverosh. And it's very interesting, the Gemara points out that sometimes we put a title before a name. We call a person Shlomo HaMelech, or HaMelech Shlomo, HaMelech David. Achashverosh is never called, at least, well, he is called in the second verse, but in the first verse, he is not referred to as HaMelech Achashverosh, or Achashverosh HaMelech. He, in the first verse, he is referred to, it was in the days of Achashverosh, he was Achashverosh who ruled, or who reigned, from Hodu to Kush, 127 medinos, countries. You'll notice it does not call him Achashverosh the king. That only appears in the second verse when he is called HaMelech Achashverosh. So the Gemara and the Medrash, which always pays very, very close attention to these little nuances, makes the point that this indicates that Achashverosh was not necessarily a legitimate monarch. He did not succeed to the Melucha because he was in the line of succession, but he was a usurper. Now, of course, Persia had already conquered Babylonia, but Achashverosh was not Mizera HaMelucha, but through various strategies and various briberies and various intrigues, he managed to install himself into the top position, and not the least of which was he married a great-granddaughter of the great Nebuchadnezzar, whose name was Vashti. And this great-granddaughter, although, once again, she's from Babylonia. Babylonia is already gone as an empire. But that gave him a certain cachet, a certain respectability as a melech. And that is why it calls him Achashverosh HaMolech, Achashverosh who rules. It does not call him the king Achashverosh. He was not legitimate. Now, the reason why, starting from Pasuk Beis, it does call him Achashverosh the king, is we will see shortly that the whole purpose of the Mishnah was to try, the party, was to legitimate his credentials as king. In other words, he wants to go. He's trying to change himself from Achashverosh HaMolech, Achashverosh who rules, into Achashverosh HaMelech, Achashverosh the king. And we're going to see exactly why he made that party. But it describes him as ruling from Hodu until Kush, 127 Medinos. Now, there's a machlokas in the Gemara, what is Hodu and Kush? Now, in modern Hebrew, Hodu is normally India, and Kush is translated as Ethiopia. If we would translate the verse that way, so we're describing an empire that ranges from Ethiopia on the west to India to the east, that would embrace a large chunk, depending on how far north it went, that embraced a large chunk of the known inhabited world, because Chazal have a Messiah that Achashverosh was one of the kings who ruled over the entire world. That is what the Gemara Megillah says. It mentions a few other kings. Shlomo HaMelech ruled over the entire world. Achav, one of the evil kings of the northern kingdom, ruled over the entire world, although that's very difficult to me because it's pretty clear that Achav did not rule over over the southern kingdom. But another king that it mentions is Nebuchadnezzar ruled over the entire world. But it would seem that when Chazal say a given king ruled over the entire world, it doesn't have to be taken literally in the sense of this king, you know, ruled over North America, etc. But it refers to the parts of the world that were inhabited and that were known in ancient times to be the seats of the primary civilizations, and therefore this would include the Eurasian, the Europe and the Asian land masses, which, you know, could roughly, although you're not including China, but it roughly includes you know, Europe and most of Asia up until, at least up until China, you include India and the like. But it's not clear, as I say, Chazal never definitively translate Hodu and Kush, so we don't really know. In fact, there are even two opinions. Some say Hodu and Kush are at the extremities, which might be India and Ethiopia. Others say Hodu and Kush were two places that were right next to each other. And when it said Achashverosh rules from Hodu to Kush, that means you're going in a reverse circle. In other words, you take a globe. So you got two points, right? Let's say, if you draw a circle, so you go 360 degrees around, so he rules from Hodu all the way to Kush next door.
Yes. So that the translation would be the Hodu Gakush even over Indian Kush, which Herodotus said was Alexander's remark after he conquered Indian Kush was, I have no more world to conquer. Rule over Indian Kush, he could rule over anything.
That's a very interesting and excellent point. Sometimes when it says from, you know, Mehodu from here until here, which in English translation or English idiom would connote extremities, and yet you find in Biblical Hebrew that the phrase from A ad B does not really connote extremities at all. Like it says by Paro, it says, or it says Michut v'atzrichna, when Avraham says, I will not take a string until a shoelace. Now, string and shoelace are the same. It's not like, you know, one thing to another thing. Or it says, all of the Jewish people gathered together to hear Moshe Rabbeinu's farewell address from the woodcutters until the water drawers. But those are not extremities. They're the same, like, servant class. So the suggestion is that in Biblical Hebrew, this expression does not mean one extreme to the other extreme, but it just means totally, even including this extremity. In other words, it's one extremity. In other words, Moshe gathered everybody, even including the water carriers and the woodcutters. According to that, therefore, Hodu and Kush, as you say, could be Indian Kush, which has been identified as Afghanistan, a very, very fierce, warlike tribe of people. That's right. To this very day, you know, these guys will fight, you know, with their bare hands in a very, very violent way. So it's basically saying Achashvei Rosh even managed to capture that particular province. So Hodu and Kush are not two extremities, but it's a single extreme province. Yeah. Yes, yes, I
know. He is connected,
he's quasi Jewish in that area, mm-hmm.
who has certain Jewish
practices, and he doesn't claim that they're Jewish, but he claims that definitely it's connected to Washington. He is, again, he's a Rav, Talmud Chacham, who his job is he identifies potential remnants of the lost 10 tribes, and often halakhically they're not Jewish for various reasons, but if they want to convert, he will facilitate conversion and help them come to Israel. So he mentioned to me that, you know, when he was identifying, you know, 10 people here, 20 people here, you know, the state of Israel was, you know, very, very supportive, gave him money and everything. But then he starts uncovering, you know, 3 million people in India, 2 million in China, you know, so he says they've been a little more reluctant. So once he starts talking about, you know, fantastically huge numbers of people who potentially might be remnants of the lost 10 tribes. I mean, keep in mind that to the extent the 10 tribes have not been totally decimated, they would represent a much larger percentage of the Jewish people than we have now, and these people haven't suffered necessarily Holocausts and pogroms and crusades. So potentially you might be dealing with a phenomenally large population.
They might have.
Huh?
They might have.
Well, they might have. We don't know. We don't have a complete history of what they've gone through. But that's what he's doing. Okay. Why don't we stop here and we'll continue tomorrow.
Like this is
a
this
McGill
is
sort of faulty. Yeah, what does it say?
Well, something
that
says
Says Meish Viad Isha, Meolel Viad Yonek, Mishor Viad Seh. That's Rashi in Kisetze. Shelo Yehe Shem Amalek Nizkar Afilu Al Habahema.
So what does it mean? You shouldn't remember it, or shouldn't take it over?
No, it means that there shouldn't be any animal by which you would remember, oh, this was an Amalek animal.
Which means you should wipe it out.
Wipe it out, that's right, that's the kasha. So that's the kasha. So how could Esther take the house of Haman? The possessions of Haman. That's the kasha. If there's a mitzvah to destroy even the property, how could Esther take it?